Accession number 29075, Reel 3.
And Meredith, Reel 3.
And the other place wasn't Chusan, it was Chinhe, where we went and played lots of football.
Successfully?
Oh, I think so, as far as I remember. Certainly, amiably.
Did you have much contact with the population of, the civilian population of Malaya?
Well, in a superficial way, yes, quite a lot. Because we did see them in the police compounds and, of course, in Kuala Lumpur. They were providing a lot of the domestic services, the support services generally, around the airfield. Quite a bit, but not in a socialising sense. There were one or two families whom one met occasionally, but not a great deal.
Were you well received or well regarded?
Oh, I think we were well regarded. Well, to a certain extent, of course, we were the power, and so people didn't want to upset us unless they wished to set out to upset us. And I think that in Malaya, people were appreciative of what was being achieved because they could now see progress. There had been a period earlier, which I would think is 1948-50, or that sort of time, when it was in the balance, and I think things were very hard there. But by 54, things were looking... certainly, progress was being made, and the CTs were on the run. After all, in about 48 or so, the CTs had control of the entire rail network. And by the time I was there, really the whole of the country was under our control, and they were a small guerrilla outfit whom we were chasing and eventually chased across the Thai border.
Was there any racial division between the Malay and the Chinese population?
Oh yeah, well, those internal things, yes, but not such as I was seeing at that time, and it's difficult to separate that time in one's mind from later. But yes, there is a racial division in that country, and it's not merely Malays and Chinese, it's Indian background too, who are mostly Tamil from southern India. But I wouldn't want to comment on that.
Could you explain a bit more about how the supply system works and what your role in it was?
Well, the Navy's supply and secretariat branch provides frontline support, at the front line. It doesn't run the big store depots. It doesn't run the procurement of the supplies. That was all civilianized and had been, always has been, from the days of Sam Pepys onwards. And our role in a ship is the best place to focus it. And there's the pay and personnel administration side of things. And in those days, the ledgers were all kept on board and people were paid in accordance with the ledgers. As time went on, of course, by the 1970s, computers had come in and there was a centralised system, but an awful lot of manual work had to be done on them as well, on the individual pay accounts. So when I was in the Ark Royal, we still had a large pay office. Of course, it was an adjunct to pay is cash, a supply officer is appointed as the cash officer usually, and as his main job, and then you've got the captain's secretary who does that part of the personnel administration which is maintaining service records and the discipline side, he makes sure that things are right for if people have to be taken before the captain, and then he runs all the correspondence as well. The catering, victualling as it always used to be called, which was food, the catering side, and also clothing and so on, that is an important feature, and you get an allowance per day for everybody on board, and you have to feed them within that as your budget. And within each of these departments or sections of the supply department, you know, there are people who have specialised in this. And that, of course, includes the cookery as well as the supply. And in my time, we moved from the broadside messing that we had in the Newcastle through to big centralised messing in the Ark Royal, where everybody was 2,000 people. Well, not quite 2,000, going through the main dining hall, about 1,800 going through the main dining hall, about 350 through the chiefs, and 300 also in the wardroom. Then there is the naval stores, the spare parts, everything from light bulbs to fairly heavy machinery stuff. And you carry around quite a bit of stock, but as the years have gone by, and certainly at the time I left the Navy, remembering I left the Navy now 18 years ago, stocks had steadily been cut back, so that one was not carrying an unnecessary amount of capital around. And when I'm talking about the Ark Royal, I'll probably allude to that. Because we had to find space. You could always go on. You get new bits of kit, you get the support stores for it. Unless you get rid of the old, you're into congestion. And again, there were budgets for certain things. Otherwise, mostly it was replacement of permanent stores, you know, on a one-for-one basis. And air stores is an adjunct, really, of the naval stores, but is rather more highly controlled, because of course the standards need to be much higher for safety. You have to be absolutely sure that you haven't left a screw in the wrong place, you know, if you're one of the aircraft engineers, and so there are all sorts of checks, you know, and tool control and that sort of thing. To which the supply side is making its contribution. And then there's the wardroom. Wardroom is run by the supply branch. In these modern days, the dining halls and all that sort of thing. But it's very much the front line support. And then there are some shore-based supply teams, and they're particularly in the naval ports. And their significance has increased in recent years as ships companies have got smaller and smaller, and they need to have oversight facilities which they can call on to do their some of the background administration, the checking, the mustering of stuff to make sure that one is fully prepared. The thing about the supply branch, though, is that there are no thanks for not being able to provide it, and no excuses either from angry captains if you've not got what they want.
Was supply something you were steered into, or something you were...
Something I was steered into, yeah, by the system, because of my exam results when I joined the Navy.
And after your time in Malaysia... What happened next?
Well, I then came back to England and went to HMS Ceres, who was at Wetherby in Yorkshire, for specialist courses as a sub-lieutenant supply. And they definitely complimented, filled in all sorts of gaps. For the group of us, we'd all had different experiences, but we'd had various things. It was all consolidated our time. We had, I suppose, 12 weeks, something like that, doing that at Ceres, which was interesting, was good. The advantages of living ashore and not in a ship. We also had divisional responsibilities for sailors, working under divisional officers who were responsible for the training of the sailors, because it was the supply branch training establishment. We had a lot of national servicemen in those days coming through, and there was really quite a big training task, and we chipped in with that, doing a lot of sort of outward bound type of things. Adventure training up over the moors of North Yorkshire. Good fun. And then after that, I came to Greenwich for what was called the Junior Officers' War Course. We had two terms, and I spent the rest of 1955 doing that, from probably late April through until the end of December. And it was a good chance to learn the art of burning the candle at both ends. Learned a lot of interesting things, but it was all a part of consolidating, completing one's training.
Did the war course allude to a combat aspect, or?
Not really. No, it was. It's a sort of staff training, really. It was a very junior staff course. It taught to appreciate the situation and do things in accordance with the approved protocol, so to speak, to start thinking about strategic issues. One was thinking about the East versus West, the Cold War, but then also the states of the Black Sea, the Far East, and the situation. There's something of geopolitical. It was the first awakening, really, in one, I suppose.
How did your responsibilities change with your promotion to sub-lieutenant?
Well, on promotion to sub-lieutenant, really not at all. If anything, had rather less responsibility because I was now just a student. So I had a year as a sub-lieutenant learning and without responsibilities, which was quite refreshing, rather nice. But then after Greenwich, I joined HMS Eagle as the captain's assistant secretary, and then one was back into the mainstream again. Eagle was one of our two large carriers at the time, or larger than the other carriers that we had. Ark Royal came along just after the Eagle, and I was in her for 8 months, January to August, in 1956. And as the captain's assistant secretary, I did most of the confidential stuff of the captain, which is mostly personnel confidential rather than in any sort of operational or strategic sense. And I also had jobs within the supply department, and I was the cook's divisional officer, for instance, which was absolutely nothing to do with my day job. So that was quite a challenge, particularly as we had 90 cooks in the ship, and I was responsible for a lot of them. It was really, my job as the captain's assistant secretary was really rather tedious, and I didn't enjoy it greatly. I didn't enjoy my immediate boss very much either. The captain was fine, but and I was also particularly working with the commander, and he was a smashing bloke. Tony Griffin, who subsequently became a full admiral, controller of the Navy, and then the chairman of British Shipbuilders. He was great, but the job as a whole was not greatly exciting. So I was thrilled one Sunday when, in August, we had been at divisions. We used to do divisions, I think, every other Sunday. A whole ship's company, all done up in their white uniforms, up on deck in the Mediterranean, and the captain would come round and did his inspection. As he was going off, at the end of it, he summoned me over to him, and he said, "You're going to be leaving us tomorrow." Well, this was news to me. And he said, "You're going to join HMS Decoy as the captain's secretary. He has been sacked." I've got him. In fact, the captain got it wrong. I was very glad he got it wrong, because the captain secretary of the Decoy was a chum of mine. And I was to go to the Duchess, which was another daring class. In fact, was the leader of that squadron of daring class. And so the next evening, having the next morning, the fellow who's going to be taking over from me, who'd just been sacked from Duchess, he came and had a one-day turnover, and I got on the boat and went over to the Duchess, where I had no turnover at all. But I think that was a very good thing that I didn't, because he'd left a most terrible mess. And I then spent a long time trying to sort that little lot out from the office point of view. But Duchess was a smashing ship. I was very lucky to get into her. She was very successful on the sports field and professionally as well. Won the fleet anti-aircraft trophy and the fleet bombardment trophy and things like that, which were quite good from a professional point of view. In fact, I remember the commander-in-chief, who was Sir Guy Grantham, coming on board to present us with a bombardment trophy, and he said how well we'd done, because the bombardment was done on a rock called Filfla, which is just off Malta, and there was a great big white painted target on Filfla, and we had hit this target pretty much at its centre from the opening salvo to the end, and we'd had to twist and weave and so on while doing so. He said that he'd been in a ship in the 1920s which had won this bombardment trophy, and they'd been running at it absolutely straight, and they had never hit Filfla, and they still got the bombardment trophy. Duchess was a very, very happy ship, very successful, brilliantly led by a very experienced captain called Nigel Alston, who had a couple of DSOs from the war, and he was the leader of the squadron, and we had a very good bunch in the wardroom as well, and a good bunch of sailors. Everything clicked, worked well, and in her went to the went to Suez. Before Suez, we had a port visit to Toulon, I remember, it was quite clear that something was building up, but I think we were all very surprised when we were sailed in this enormous convoy, and it was the speed of the convoy was that of the slowest ship, which was about 5 or 6 knots, and our ships, the Darings, really couldn't go that slow for very long. So we did huge, long to and fro transits at right angles to the main course of the convoy, just so that we could have all our fans working in the engine room and boiler room. And that was a sort of fairly long and dreary period, until we were running in, and Duchess was the lead ship going down just to the west of the mole, and we opened the bombardment. And I was the gun direction officer visual, up in the director, above, behind the bridge, controlling the 4-5 guns. And, of course, the history of the story of Suez is very well known. I mean, the whole business of collusion and that sort of thing was nothing of which we were aware. But then the campaign came to a halt after 36 hours or something, and we remained in the area, but being detached to go off and do Cyprus patrols, because Cyprus patrolling was going on the whole time because of the AOKA problem there, which was actually, it was quite good to get away from the Suez. But then we would come back, and we had the Argyles as our chummy regiment, and we would have them down and give them showers and decent meals and that sort of thing. Then when we withdrew, the Duchess was the last ship that was withdrawing, the last ship out. We did leave a landing ship, which I think was the Stalker, but I might be wrong there, there with supporting the divers who are doing the mine clearance in the canal. But Duchess was the last ship out, and it was really quite a tense. Okay, we were way down in the entrance of the canal, inside the mole, and we waited to pick up a young British officer, who I think his name was Moorhead, who had been kidnapped by the Egyptians and was being used as a bargaining counter. And we waited. We were due to pick him up at the de Lesseps statue at midnight, I think, and a boat was inshore with Lieutenant Miles Rivet Carnac in charge, but Moorhead never appeared, and it subsequently appeared that he had been murdered by the Egyptians. So anyway, we eventually recalled the boat quite a bit after midnight, hoisted it, and got out of it. We were the last out.
How much were you personally and as a ship aware of the bigger picture at the time?
Depends what one means by the bigger picture. We, of course, were well aware of the nationalisation of the canal and all of that sort of thing. But as far as the collusion with the French, not at all. We were aware through the news media of the pressure being put on the British government by the Americans, and there were dark rumours that the Russians had sent a few regiments of aircraft into Damascus, all to come and deal with us. So it was really quite jumpy during the 36 hours, if it was that, before the we said we'd stopped, and then things clearly eased off again. But that was the only part of the bigger picture, really, that we were aware of. We were not aware of the political side of things, and certainly not the allegations, as it now is, of collusion. I mean, there must have been some intelligence information to which my captain was privy, but I was not. But I don't think he knew a great deal more than I did.
Was there much apprehension about the going into action?
Well, there's always apprehension about going into action, because there are uncertainties and you don't know what's going to happen, and is your own equipment going to work all right? Are you going to have a shell explode on you before you fire it, and that sort of thing. But the threats against us, we were not regarded
very great. I mean, we were running an anti-submarine protection, but there wasn't a really known Egyptian submarine threat. The air threat, I suppose, was the thing that we regarded the most seriously. And yet there was apprehension. In the wardroom, there was quite a lot of talk about making a serious political mistake, but that was uninformed. It was our own view, but you know, we had to get on with the job we'd been told to do. But we thought that it was a grave mistake, as indeed it has proved.
Does the spirit of the ship make a difference to how people are feeling?
I think it does. But I haven't been in a ship in that sort of situation where the spirit was not good. But there was one of our squadron where the spirit wasn't very good, and there was quite a lot of questioning going on. But it never became anyway mutinous or anything like that. That's the point of building up spirit and building effectiveness of training, because it gives people mutual confidence in each other and in their ship. That's the same from Nelson and before Nelson, since.
You mentioned the threat of air attack.
Mm.
How should it have occurred? How was Duchess and the convoy as a whole defended?
Well, we had our defences, had our guns. And we had, for its time, what was regarded as an effective computer system to control the guns, fly plane. Who knows whether it would have worked. The main defence was provided by the cap, which came from the aircraft carriers. And they maintained a combat air patrol cap, I think, throughout the whole of the time. And they, as well, the carriers, had airborne early warning aircraft, which was almost certainly sky raiders, I should think, at the time. And they would have been looking out for any actual threats inbound. It was probably not a very serious threat, but it was the one for which we, certainly on board, thought that was the most likely. And later on, of course, particularly after the ceasefire, there were the sort of security threats of somebody coming along and putting a limpet mine on you and that sort of thing. So we were protecting ourselves against that as best we could.
Do you know why the previous Captain Secretary of Duchess had been sacked?
Oh, yes. He was absolutely hopeless. Things were just a terrible muddle. It's sad, really, because he was much older than me. He'd been a lieutenant for 7 years. It was supposed to be a job as the leader of the squadron's secretary, having somebody more senior, and he had not kept up with the correspondence. He filed a lot of things away in his bottom drawer, and he had actually failed to respond to a signal to come and get orders for an exercise, and so the ship was there scrubbing and everything else, where everybody else was stood to having this exercise, and that was the last straw for everybody concerned, and he got sacked.
Did he then take over your position on Eagle?
Yeah. And he lasted there for about 3 months, and then he left the Navy.